replenish, reimagine, recapture, rise.
Welcome to Dr. Ryan Berg.
Joseph called me my young friend. I appreciate that. We'll keep that going. Thank you. So what I'm going to show you is some research about a book that I wrote with actually two pastors from Orlando, Florida, named Michael Graham and Jim Davis, called The Great Dechurching, which I think is important because everything I've done to this point is, well, I'm showing you all the people that are leaving religion. Why are they leaving? And so the purpose of the book is to answer that question, really, is why, when people leave church, why? And then the corollary of that is, well, then what would get them back to church? So we ask both those questions in a huge survey. So let me show you the scope of the problem. So this is the share of Americans who report attending church weekly in the red, and then the share of Americans who report never attending religious services in the blue. And, oh, by the way, this is being recorded. That's what I was supposed to say, right? This is being recorded. It's going to go on the website somewhere at some point. And what I did was I overlaid these percentages with actual raw numbers from the Census Bureau. So you get a sense of like how many people that we're talking about. In America today, there's about 330 million-ish Americans. So in 2008, about 45 million Americans said they never attended religious services. And 70 million said they attended church weekly or more than once a week. So huge, 25 million more people were weekly attenders than were never attenders. And then over time, the never attending line goes up and the weekly attending line goes flat-ish, down a little bit. And what you see, and this is something that like I'm really surprised that no one wrote like a big splashy New York Times headline about this, but around 2017 or 2018, the number of Americans who never attended religious services actually exceeded the number who were attending weekly for the first time in American history. So this is a very new phenomenon. This is like a last 10-year phenomenon, not a last 50-year phenomenon. So what we're seeing here is very recent stuff, not very ancient stuff. And so, according to data from 2022, the share of Americans who never attend is now 85 million, and the share who attend weekly has dropped to 62 million. But notice, the drop in the weekly attenders is actually pretty small, right? About 8 million, because the share, the percentage number hasn't changed that much. It's just the share of Americans has gone up, right? So that's what led to that drop. The never attending number has just absolutely exploded. I mean, 85 million people is a whole lot of people in a country of 330 million or so. So we're talking about 25, 28% of Americans now never attend religious services. Let me put those numbers in context for you, though. Like, so how many is, you know, when I say 85 million, like how many actually is that? In the book, we note that 15% of all adult Americans have dechurched in just the last 15 years. So 15% of Americans have gone in that never attending category. In terms of number of people, remember we're going from 45 million to about 85 million. That's 40 million people left church in just the last 15 years or so. Here's where it really came home to me. We were trying to figure out ways to make that number make sense to people. The 40 million people that have left religion in the last 15 years are more people than joined the church between the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, and every Billy Graham revival held in the United States combined. Just think about that for a second. Okay, so all the success that America had during the First Great, when we went from being a not very religious country to a religious country during both Great Awakenings. You know, we talk about the success of pastors like George Whitefield and people standing in fields and accepting Jesus. And then think about Billy Graham, right? I mean, how many crusades did Billy Graham? I grew up in a Southern Baptist household, and my dad looked at me one time and goes, "Son, we don't have a pope, but Billy Graham's really close." I mean, we watched Billy Graham revivals, you know, like it was just like viewing. And all remember all the people that would come down the walkways down to the stage, and I mean thousands of people, you know, all the work Billy Graham did, and all the work that was done in the first and second Great Awakening have all been erased in the last 15 years. That's the scope of the problem. Okay, that's what we're talking about here. And of those 40 million people who have de-churched, 15 million of them have left evangelical churches, and we classify Seventh-day Adventists as evangelical, by the way. So that's your church too, but also Southern Baptist Convention, Assemblies of God, those non-denominational churches you guys see popping up all over America. That's actually the fastest growing religious group in America today, by the way, after the nuns. I would say the two biggest stories in American religion are the rise of the nuns and the rise of the nons, non-denominational. There are 22 million non-denominational Christians in America today. That's more than any other denomination. Non-denominational is the largest denomination, if you want to go that route. But we're talking 15 million people left evangelical churches out of 40 million people. But 40 million people is a lot of people, you know? I mean, we're talking about a massive problem. So, like I said, myself and my two co-authors, Jim Davis and Michael Graham, who I'm actually going to see today. I've actually never met one of them in person. We wrote a book without ever actually meeting. God bless the internet. Right, you can know people without actually being in a room with people, and I'm going to meet Jim for the first time actually this afternoon, going to his church. Here's how we define a de-churched person. It's an adult American who used to attend the congregation monthly or more frequently, so at least once a month, and then today they attend seldom or never. So we basically ask two survey questions. One was, when you were the most religious, how often do you attend religious services? And currently, how often do you attend religious services? And so if you said, at my most religious, I attended at least once a month, so monthly, weekly, or more than once a week, and then you ask today, how much do you attend? You say seldom or never, you're de-churched. That's our definition of de-churching, okay? So we base this on behavior, which we think is actually the most important dimension of religion, like going to church, not how you identify, but what you actually do is probably the most important thing. Going on a regular basis matters. And by the way, monthly is not a huge, not a high bar, FYI. It's just, you know, I mean, you went some, you were part of a church at one point, and now you're basically not part of a church. So we did three surveys. This is why you don't see, everyone's like, why don't we see more books written like The Great De-Churching? Can I give you a simple answer? Because it loses money. That's really the answer. To do the data for this book cost almost $100,000. And that money came exclusively through donations from organizations. Actually, I don't even know where the money came from, honestly. I didn't ask. I'm just happy to have the data. But my friends Michael and Jim knew a lot of people in these circles who wanted to understand this phenomenon more and wrote checks to us, and they wanted to understand this phenomenon more. That's the only way this book makes sense. You cannot write books like this and make money. There's just no money to be made. So this has to be a philanthropic effort. But we think, hopefully, it's valuable to the church to do this kind of work. So all that to say, data is important. We need more of it. You'd be amazed at the things we don't understand about religion right now. Some very basic stuff we have no understanding of. So three surveys. One was just a general population survey. Two was just de-churched people. So just specifically people who used to go monthly or more and now go seldom or never. And then we did a third survey, which was just de-churched evangelicals. So people used to go to an evangelical church and now don't. That survey was really hard to do because that's not a huge population, but I work with a really great survey firm to get us where we wanted to go on that. So what you're seeing here is all the end result of these surveys, okay? Everything here is data-driven. We don't base anything on anecdotes. I want to make that crystal clear. This is, I'm a data guy, as you can probably tell from in there. I live and breathe data. I think data can help us understand the broad world, right? Not just what I see in my church. And a lot of what I do, by the way, is talking to pastors and say, okay, what you're seeing is actually happening other places too. It's not just you. So what we did was we kind of separated groups into two different types of de-churching. The first type we call casual de-churching, okay? And this, to me, there's like one thing, one simple thing from the book, which you should still buy the book, by the way, but I'll give you the one simple thing that I can't stop thinking about. The number one reason why evangelicals left their church is that first bullet point right there. They moved. That is the number one reason why people de-church, is because they moved. We want to think it's this sort of like really like dramatic process. We're like, oh, I hate God, or the pastor said something that offended me, or I got divorced, or, you know, something really like theologically consequential or politically consequential, and so we left. The vast majority of people in our survey just left because they just didn't see it being valuable anymore. Which in some ways is actually good, in some ways is bad, because it's like, why can we not be more relevant to people? You know, why don't they care? The way I describe this is a lot of people left and just their life didn't change for the worse, and they're like, well, why would I go back? You know, what am I gaining? I'm losing more than I'm gaining, because I got to get up in the morning, go to church, and do all that stuff. So people moved. Number one reason why people left religion is because they moved and they just didn't get hooked up with a new community. That's really it. We call these people casual de-churching, because it wasn't like this one and done. It was like a dimmer switch instead of a light switch. You guys get what I mean here? They just slid away from religion over time and never came back. Wasn't this big, you know, moment in time. Now, there are people who we did find in the survey that we call de-church casualties who did leave because of like major life events, okay? For instance, they didn't fit in with the congregation. Let's say that they were African-American, the church was largely white, or they were politically liberal and the church was conservative, or they got divorced and, you know, that wasn't really super welcome in the congregation. But there's also people who got hurt by church for all kinds of reasons. You know, I think we all know people like that. We talk about spiritual abuse a lot. That's something we really tried to explore a lot in the book, and there's no way to say this without saying it. It doesn't appear to be the case that lots and lots of people left the church because of spiritual abuse. That just doesn't, if you look at the data, you don't see this clear narrative of like, yeah, the church hurt me, or like I was gay, or I was abused physically, emotionally, sexually in the church, and that's why I left. It really just doesn't pop as an answer. I'm not convinced that that is the primary reason why lots and lots of people leave church. The other, the casual de-churching, is the lion's share of why people leave religion. They just slide away slowly. And the worst part is, if you ask them why they left, they can't really articulate a great answer to you as to why. It's just like, you know, it just didn't do anything for me. It didn't change my life. So here's what we did. I put together an algorithm. I know that's a big like buzzword right now. Everyone has an algorithm. So this is, to give you a 30-second explanation how this works, is we basically gave the algorithm a bunch of different variables in the data set. It said find commonalities between these groups. So you guys have a Kroger? You guys ever go to Kroger? That little card you scan and you get money off and all that stuff? You guys know why you do that? Because all those purchases are logged to your account and they know who you are over time. They realize what you like to buy and what you don't like to buy, and they give you coupons based on your spending habits. So they really make like three or four groups of you and then send out three or four different coupon packets. Guess what they do that? An algorithm called clustering. So they're finding patterns in the data by doing that, and guess what I did? The exact same thing, except when it comes to religion data. So what we did was let's look at these de-churched evangelical people and then try to find different groups inside these de-churched people. So what I'm going to show you for the rest of this is a more description of these four groups, and then why they left, and then what would bring them back. Okay? So we have cultural Christians, mainstream evangelicals, ex-evangelicals, you guys heard that term before, I would assume, maybe at some point, and then BIPOC, which stands for Black, Indigenous, and Persons of Color. So basically non-white. So there's this term called Deus Ex Machina, which means God in the machine. I intentionally left out any racial data from the algorithm. I didn't want that to sort on racial things. It still sorted all the people, not all, but the vast majority of people of color into one category by themselves. Like it saw race without me showing it race, which is like, I had one of those weird like what moments when we did that, but it continued to show up in the data over and over again. So let's talk about each group individually. One, cultural Christians. We ask them a bunch of questions about like kind of traditional evangelical orthodoxy, like Jesus Christ is the Son of God, salvation only comes through Jesus Christ, you know, there's only one true way to salvation, kind of traditional Christian orthodoxy type questions. They scored right in the middle of those orthodoxy questions. So when we talk about their theological beliefs, these cultural Christians are sort of lukewarm, I guess is the best way to describe it about evangelical theology. But I'll point out two things to you on those questions. Only 1% of them said Jesus is the Son of God. So they score higher on other questions than the exclusivist questions. 1% of them said Jesus is the Son of God, and only 22% of them said the Bible is the literal Word of God. So they're sort of like vaguely orthodox, like kind of orthodox, but not in a way that a lot of evangelicals would understand orthodoxy, okay? They're definitely not atheists. They're definitely not agnostics. They're definitely not Hindus or Buddhists, but they're not completely evangelical in the way we would understand evangelical is today. And what's interesting about this group is they were very engaged in high school and college ministry. So they grew up, I think, the way I think about this group in my head is these are people who grew, their parents made them go to church a lot when they were kids. And they did go to church a lot when they were kids. And they actually continued a lot of that when they went to college. And then they sort of drifted away over time. They would still call themselves Christians, by the way. Like, they're still culturally Christian. They're just not theologically evangelical. When it comes to how they view the Bible and Jesus and things like that. So here's why they left. These are the top four reasons. And you can see that three of them clearly fall into the category of that casual de-churching. Okay? So why did I leave? Well, attending was inconvenient, which is like the most blah answer ever, right? Like, it's hard to go to church. Well, it's hard to go anywhere. It's hard to go to work, but you go anyway. My friends were not attending worship services. I moved to a new community, like we just talked about. That scores high and all that. And then the fourth one of the four is the bottom right. Suffering changed my views of God and or the congregation. So of the top four reasons they gave for why they left, three of them are definitely what I would call more social, more logistical, and one is more theological, more vertical. When I think about religion a lot, I think about the vertical versus the horizontal dimension of religion. Three of these are horizontal and one of them is vertical, okay? About suffering and how to deal with suffering and how they had a hard time with suffering, something happened in their lives. So, why they might return? The number one answer for why they might return, by a large margin, friends. That's number one, friends. And you know what number two is? Friends, right? Just a variation on the friends theme. Lonely, need new friends, want to make new friends, friends. Friends are friends forever, if the Lord's the Lord of them, right? That's right, Michael W. Smith. What a great song. You guys know that song? Yeah, that's a great one, isn't it? Love Michael W. Smith. And then the other two are sort of like more spiritual-ish, I would think, ish. One is supernatural phenomena. I mean, like they have like an epiphany, you know, like something happens to them. It's like, let's go back to church. Or they begin to miss church. But clearly what leads the way here is one and two, which is friends. It's the horizontal dimension of religion, not necessarily the vertical dimension of religion. And these are cultural Christians. So the number one reason they'd come back is friends, friends, friends. They'll come back if they have friends. Okay. Now, mainstream evangelicals are really frustrating because they look like people who go to church, but they don't go to church. It's like, just go to church, people. You're orthodox. On this orthodoxy score, it goes from 0 to 100%. They scored 86%, which is really, really high. It's the highest of any of the four groups that we have. Almost all of them said Jesus is the Son of God. And 60% of them believe the Bible is the literal Word of God, which is pretty high as a guy who looks at these measures a lot. So on these metrics, they look a lot like a pew-sitting person in your church, theologically. So it's not they don't believe. That's not what's happening here. They believe probably as much as anybody who goes to church. They had above average college ministry involvement. They had high youth involvement. Again, these are people who grew up in the church. right? Their parents made them go on a regular basis. They like being there and all those kind of things. They're there often. So why did they leave? Again, these are the top four reasons. So these are people who are theologically evangelical, okay? Theologically orthodox. Why did they leave? Do you notice a commonality between these four reasons? They're all social stuff. They're not theological things, guys. There's nothing theological on that scores even in the top five with these mainstream evangelicals. I moved. Attending was inconvenient. COVID got me out of the habit, or I divorced, I got remarried, I had kids, another family change. Does anything there have to do with God? Not really. I mean, there's nothing there that's about religion. It's about outside things that lead to religion. And so for the way I understand these people is they like the idea of religion, they just don't like doing it, like going to church. They don't want, they believe in Jesus, they believe in the Bible, they believe in God, they score really high on orthodoxy, they just don't show up. Just show up, right? Like, just be there. So why would they come back? Hey, you know what scores number one again? Friends are friends forever. Friends is number one. Now, number two is a theological thing, which is that God tells me to go back in a significant way. Because remember, they're theologically still pretty orthodox. They believe in God. They believe in Jesus. They believe in these things. So they still have a spiritual connection to church. They're just not going. And that's the frustrating part is, this is where survey data becomes really hard, because you want to go to, like, you want to go find these people individually and go, yeah, but can you explain to me why you're not there? Like, really explain to me, right? And I don't think they could even explain to themselves why they're not there, because they're just not. That's the end. And so I find a church I like, which I think we can all admit, right? I think part of that is, like, if you move, that's the hardest thing for me to do is figure out, you know, what find a new church. My church closed down in July. I was a pastor there for 17 and a half years. We closed because we had 8 people on an average Sunday. And I've been trying to find a church since then. Let me tell you, it's not fun. Not having a good time right now. But I'm going. But it's a slog. So you're like, well, let's try out a new church this Sunday. And I don't know if I'm going to like it or not. And they got 3 books there. And I don't understand how those books work together. And you can't follow along. And you don't know anybody. Everyone tries to be extra helpful and friendly. And you're like, I don't want you to be friendly right now. I just want to sit in the back and see if I like it or not. You all know what I mean, right? As a pastor, I had to tell my people, if someone new walks in, please do not attack them. Like, just chill. Just have some chill, okay? Like, if they come back in week 2 and 3, then, like, you know, like, don't be cold to them in week 1, but good gravy, don't, like, 8 people's, where are you from? What's your name? How long have you been here? You got kids? Like, just be cool, you know? Like, be normal. And that's the thing. It's like, I think a lot of these people are theologically inclined to go to church. They just can't find a church that makes any sense to them, right? That they feel comfortable at. So, okay. Now, ex-evangelicals. That's a term you've heard before, maybe. It's a person who is defined by what they're not, right? They used to be an evangelical, and now they're a not evangelical. If you're on the social media, which I don't recommend you do, but if you are, you're going to hear a lot of these people be very loud on social media about leaving the church and about how bad the church is, and they talk about, you know, patriarchy and purity culture and Donald Trump and all that kind of good stuff. Well, here's a statistic for you. You know what the share of Americans who are ex-evangelical is? General population? 3% of Americans are ex-evangelical. 3%. These are people who we ask, are you current, or would you, at any point in your life, would you have said you're an evangelical? And they say yes. And then we ask them, are you currently an evangelical? And they say no. That's 3% of Americans. 3%. So it's a group that is small but loud, and you hear about them a lot. So let's just contextualize this, okay? Now, on orthodoxy, they actually score pretty darn good, better than I would have guessed than the fact they left the church. There's this term in this kind of literature called religious residue, which is, even if you leave religion, there's still this sort of like residue that hangs around in your life for a long time, and it still like shapes your worldview and how you approach things. They still have a lot of religious residue. Okay, they score very well on orthodoxy, not to the top, but above average. 97% of them say Jesus is the Son of God, and 44% believe the Bible is the literal word of God. This is the key, though, for this group, I think. They were really involved in youth group, but really not involved in college ministry. So if you want to say, where did the drop-off happen? It's college. Yeah, it's early 20s, late teens. That's where the leaky boat for them, you know, sprung a leak, and they went the other direction. Evangelicals. So, why did they leave? I didn't fit in. I moved to a new community. Attending was inconvenient. I didn't experience much love within the congregation. So three of those four are very much logistical things, right? I moved. Attending was inconvenient. I didn't fit in. But I didn't experience much love with the congregation too. I think that's important, is a lot of these, a lot of people leave evangelicalism because of politics, to be completely honest with you. You know, that's really the end all be all of it, is they wanted to vote for a candidate that most people, and listen, I know this for a fact, most pastors don't talk about politics from the pulpit. They just don't. That's a statistical reality. I never did, because I didn't want to get fired, you know? But where do they hear it? They hear it from the pews. You know, in the Sunday school class, in the Bible study class, in the hallways, on the way in and way out, on the bumper stickers of the cars. You know, think about that. Like the subtle things that we hear and see help us understand. Whenever I go to a new church, I get asked to do these talks a lot, and I go into the church and I try to figure out real quick where they are politically. And it doesn't take long a lot of times to figure out, you know, who most people in that church are voting for by just walking around the building for 5 minutes. You can pretty much figure it out. There's a great paper written in 1988 about churches as political communities. We all say, oh, we're not political. Yeah, you are. You're putting out a political message where you think so or not. And a lot of ex-evangelicals, they're very attuned to that. They're looking for those kind of little cues. So why would they go back? Well, first off, I have to point out number fourth is I would never go back. 21% of them said, I'm never going back, period. They're done. But that also means that 80% of them might consider going back under certain circumstances, right? So a good pastor, I find a church I like, God tells me to go back in some significant way. These are more like controllable things, I think, than the other groups. Like the church could actually do something here. And by the way, when we talk about a good pastor, they probably mean a pastor that's more politically aligned with them, is what I would guess, right? So, one more. Oh, okay, so retention, yeah. We talk about that. The word we use is retention. Like, if you have kids, do they stay in church? Oh, the answer to that question is, it used to be that whenever you had kids, you would come back to church because you want your kids to be raised with the same moral foundation that you were. That applied to the boomers really well. It applied to no subsequent generation. So Gen X and millennials and Gen Z, there's absolutely no evidence in the data that having kids brings them back to church. That's called a life cycle effect. That's the fancy name for it. And like you see it all over church literature, church growth literature, and it worked really, really well 30 years ago, but there's absolutely no evidence that when people have kids, they come back to church. They're just gone. Yes?
The never category.
Former
slide.
Yeah.
Are they ever open to going to the mainline Protestant churches or Catholic churches? Because, I mean, we live in a society where ways of labeling aren't quite the same as it was for the older generations. Has there been any statistics or data coming in that shows them open to going somewhere else, just not evangelical churches that might be fighting over who's the next president?
Yeah, so evangelicals have always been better at retaining their young people than other traditions have. So even today, about 70% of kids raised evangelical will still be evangelical as adults. In other traditions, it's about 55%, so they still do a lot better. When they leave, where do they go? Half go to the main line and half go to nuns. Okay. So, yeah, about... But the main line's weird because a lot of them actually end up being nuns in the main line. They don't go to the evangelical church.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that a lot of, not most of these...
this data is... Let's get more excited about the data, guys, apparently. Good gracious.
Non-denominational churches would be mostly in the evangelical.
Correct. Yeah, we classify them blanket evangelical because if you go to the average non-denominational church,
with no name on it.
Yeah, they're Southern Baptist without the label. Yes, sir.
I'm curious, do the Latter-day Saints track with these same statistics?
Okay, so LDS are incredibly hard to track because there's so few of them in America. They're 1% of America. I was just working on a project about looking at their retention rates. They've actually gone down dramatically over the last 40 years. So it used to be 80% of LDS, people raised LDS were still LDS, and now it's about 40%. So they're losing most of their youth now, which is a real problem. Actually, the LDS church has crested in America, the membership numbers. And I don't know how to say this without saying this. The LDS kind of cooks their books a little bit on membership. I'm just going to be dead honest with you. It's really hard to leave the LDS. You have to get a notarized letter to leave the LDS church. Exactly. Because I think, I think in some ways they're trying to keep their numbers looking good by making it really hard to be disenrolled. You guys get what I'm saying?
They just don't attend.
Yeah, they just don't attend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But again, LDS is 1% of America. Like, let's contextualize this, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nominally.
Yes.
They paid for their utilities. They paid their...
Yep.
And so that to get them away from that was social.
Oh, it's a very insular community. You know, it's not just church. It's like your car dealer's LDS, your insurance agent's LDS, your church's LDS, your school's LDS. It's everything you do. And that's why it's harder and harder to leave. But if you get outside of Utah, there's not that many LDS in America, guys. Like, yeah. In Arizona, it's 6%. And that's like a big LDS state. So they're very geographically concentrated in that one spot. And I think there's a lot of things to say about that. Anyway, let me get through this and we'll go questions. BIPOC, remember? Black, Indigenous, people of color. So anyone who's really non-white fell in this bucket. It's hard to talk about where they... Did my battery die? I think my battery died. Oh my God. Oh, it's back. No, it didn't die. I didn't do that. 58% orthodoxy score, 13% said Jesus is the Son of God, 29% said Bible is a literal word of God, low youth but high college involvement, which we were really struck by because most people don't get super engaged in college ministry. Really odd group in some ways. They actually scored the highest on education and the highest on income of any of these four groups is this group here. So it's a very interesting group that really didn't fit with other groups that well. Why did they leave? I moved to a new community. You guys are seeing what I'm saying about the moving thing, right? The moving thing is big. Moved to a new community. I had other priorities for my time. Faith just wasn't working, and suffering changed my view of God. So really, of this, like, two out of the four are, like, more horizontal things, and two out of the four are more vertical things, right? So more religion, more social stuff. So it's really hard to get a real strong sense of what these people are up to, and why would they return? Friends. Gosh, I feel like I'm a broken record up here. But it just is what it is, right? The data points us to a really clear conclusion. Friends, friends, friends. Number two, friends. Number three, friends. You know what number four is?
Friends.
Friends, really, at the end of the day, isn't it? My child wants to go, why?
Friends.
You see how that works? I mean, I just cannot stress this point enough, guys. It's like pastors, I hate to say this, they're not coming because of you. Like, let's just get real about this, okay? Yes, I think the pastor can make you leave, but it's probably not going to make you stay. You know, they're going to stay because they're sitting next to people in the pews they want to sit next to, not because of how good. And listen.
That's how churches evaluate.
Yes.
Speaker and all that.
Yes. Like, do we have a good preacher or not? And the answer is, do we have a good preacher? Does it matter? Yeah, on the margins, I think it matters. But you know what the data says? It's about, can I get a new battery?
I don't know. Just don't hold this part.
Don't hold that part?
Yeah.
Hold it up here? But it won't turn on.
Don't cover this.
Don't cover that. The problem, okay. The battery is dead. Do we have any, we don't have any batteries? Oh, we got to stick this in the charger. Oh, do I get to yell? I'm going to put my hand up here. Okay, it's still red. Let's go. Five things. One, we are currently in the largest and fastest religious shift in the history of the United States, and I'm not overstating that by any stretch of the imagination. We are going through the weirdest period in American religious history, and it's happened between 1990 and 2020, okay? I actually think we're in a really, if you look at the rise of the nuns, I didn't talk about that in there, they've actually crested right now, and the rise is slowing significantly right now. So the battery is dead. So the nuns are rising slowly right now, They're only going up about 0.5% a year when they're going up 1.5% or 2% every year. So we're in a different period of American history right now when it comes to religion. It's really important to note that what happened the last 30 years is not going to happen the next 30 years. We're not going to see the nuns get to 60%. That's not going to happen. There's no data that says that's going to happen. The nuns are at 30% right now. They might end up being 40% when I die, hopefully in 150 years from now. Okay? This era we're in is different. So, over half the people who are de-churched actually are open to the idea of returning. Okay? So we talk about 40 million people who have left religion. 20 million of them plus are at least open somewhat to the idea of coming back. So, like I said in there and I said in here, it's not like when people leave, they go, okay, I'm done with you, I'm moving on, you know, that's over. That door is closed in my life. Most people who leave religion are not done with religion. They are open to the idea of coming back, which creates the largest mission field we've ever had in the United States. Okay? The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few, as the scriptures say. Yeah, they're in the meh category. Very few people are like, I hate religion, I'm done with faith, I'll never come back, it's all awful. Most people are like, meh. And the meh is what you want, by the way. Because the meh means they'll listen to you. They're persuadable. They're not turned off by religion. Okay, this is something really, really important. Really, really important. If I can make one point in my life with the data, it is this point. Education and de-churching are inversely related. Guess who's the most likely to de-church? The least educated. The people who are the most likely to be weekly church attenders today in America are people with graduate degrees. The people who are the least likely to be weekly attenders in America are people who did not graduate high school. Let me say that again. The people who are the most likely to be in church this Sunday are people with a master's degree or more.
Interesting. You would think it was the other way around.
Why? Because dropping out begets dropping out. Do you see what I'm saying when I say that? Why do people... Church is an institution. From a social science perspective, religion is an institution. You know what else is an institution? Education is an institution. What we know is that people who graduate college have higher levels of trust, interpersonal and institutional trust, than people who don't. And guess what you need to do to be part of a church? Oh, I got a microphone now. Get out of here. Thank you, sir. The people who are the most likely to be in church this Sunday are people with, by the way, the combination of income and education that's most important. College degree making between $60,000 and $100,000 a year. That's the magic number. If you said, go find someone who's, you know, pick someone in a group of people who's most likely to come to church on Sunday, that's the combination I would pick. The middle class. Yep, the middle class. And if you want to get even more technical, people who are married with children. That is the magic combination. A married 30-year-old is twice as likely to attend church on a weekly basis as an unmarried 30-year-old. Well, pastors, you should tell your people to have kids, lots of kids, because the best way to keep your church alive in 30 years is retention, not evangelism. That's what the data says. To go back to the LDS for a minute, every young man in the LDS church is supposed to go on a mission. When they turn 18, graduate high school, they're supposed to take a 2-year mission. They put them all over the world for 2 years. They're supposed to work 40 hours a week, knocking doors and evangelizing. You know how many converts the average missionary gets in 2 years? One. The answer is one. So you can equip a missionary, send him out for 40 hours a week for 2 years and get one yield. One. Or you can have 3 kids and keep them all.
They have 7 or 8 kids.
Yeah. But you see what I mean, though. If your retention rate's 70% and you only have 2 kids, you're losing a lot of kids. If you have five kids and you keep 70%, you know what I'm saying here, right? Which is easier, having kids and keeping them or trying to bring new people in? I'll pick retention over evangelism every day of the week, twice on Sunday. Evangelism is crazy hard. Retention is crazy easy. It's getting harder, but it's still a whole lot easier. So, guys, the people who are the most likely to be in your church, college degree, making between $600,000 a year. You get above that, they go less. You get below that, they go less. Dropping out begets dropping out. Institutional trust drives people to go to these institutions. Remember I showed you in there how, guess what? The nothing in particulars have the lowest income, the lowest education, or the least politically active. You see the pattern that's emerging here? They're not engaging in society. They're dropping out of American society in every possible way. And in many ways, it's making their entire situation in life worse because they don't have connections to the rest of the church community, right? There was a great, I'm going off on a tangent, but you'll like this. There was a great paper published 2 years ago by Raj Chetty, who is a Harvard economist, probably one of the best economists living in the world. He got Facebook to give him the anonymous data from 44 million people. Don't ask me why, I don't know how, okay? Over 2 billion connections between those 44 million people. What he was looking for is places where people were friending people who were economically diverse from them. So if you were lower class, people were at a higher level than you. They did not find that in the workplace. You guys know why, right? Because blue-collar people work with blue-collar people and white-collar people work with white-collar people. They didn't find it in neighborhoods because, you live based on your income. They didn't find it at schools. Why? Schools are based on geography. You know the only place they found real economic diversity was? Church. So church is one of the very few engines left in American society where people at the bottom end of the income spectrum can make friends with people who are managers and owners and small business people and work their way up in the American system. I mean, think about that. Can I tell you a story real quick? I went to a church in college. It was a Free Methodist church. It was liturgical. You guys aware of that word, liturgy? Yeah, very, you know, the structure is very distinct structure and order. Well, I come in right before church starts because that's what I do, right? I don't want to have a big conversation with people. I sit in the second to last row. Yeah, I'm a back row Baptist. You better believe it. But I wasn't back row that day. I was second to back row. A guy walks in, okay? He was younger than me and I was in college. And he had a girlfriend or a wife and she had a baby on her hip. They were sitting in the back row, okay? We go through most of the service. There's this part called Prayers of the People. Have you guys heard of this before, Prayers of the People? Okay, so here's how it works. The worship leader will read like a written prayer. You pray for the country, you pray for the denomination, you pray for, you know, the big kind of broad things. And then you open it up to the congregation. You say, do you have any prayer requests? And usually someone will say, well, my Aunt Susan got diagnosed with cancer. And the pastor will say, Lord, in your mercy. And the congregation will say, hear our prayer. Okay, it's just a nice thing, man, because it feels like in that moment, everyone is pulling for you. You know, like they all just want you to be better. Like I'm traveling, you know, we're going somewhere, Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. It usually is four or five sentences, you know, like four or five people will say a sentence or two, and you close up a little prayer and you go on to the next thing, okay? This time, we were almost done with Prayers of the People. The kid behind me chimes in at the very end and goes, could you all pray for me? I lost my job. And I don't know how I'm going to afford rent at the end of the month. And we all said, pastor said, Lord, in your mercy. We all said, hear our prayer. Went to the next part of the service, because that's what you do, right? Because we do liturgy here. When the service was over, I saw an older gentleman in the front take a beeline directly to the back. He goes, son, I own the lumber yard in town, and if you want a job, you can come work for me tomorrow. Lord, in your mercy. Right? That's the church. That's what the church is supposed to be. And yes, does it save your soul? Yes, but man, it also digs you out of poverty sometimes too. And isn't that important? Yeah. To me, we don't talk about that part of the church enough, right? Go to church so you don't go to hell. How about go to church so you can have friends? So you can build up a social network. So you can find, when you're in your worst moment, who lifts you up? When we had both of our boys, we came home. You know what's sitting on our front step? Soup made by people from the church. Who's going to bring the meatloaf? The church folks are. And the more and more people that drop, and guess who needs that the most? The people who are there the least.
Yeah.
And that's how we're pulling ourselves apart economically. That's what, I'm writing a book about this right now called The Big Church Sort. It's about how we're sorting ourselves out politically, but also we're sorting ourselves out economically and socially in the church. And it's causing all these problems for us as individuals, for the church, and for democracy. I think the church is an absolute essential component of a functioning democracy, and we're making things worse right now, not better. When for most of American history, we were a great meeting place of people at the top and people at the bottom. John Rockefeller was worth $100 billion in 1900, right? He never left his house except to go to work and go to church. He was an American Baptist, by the way, which is what I am, so there you go. He was asked, why do you go through all the hassle? There's all these reporters outside, everyone's asking you for money, and it's all spectacle. And he said, it's my only opportunity to talk to a blacksmith or a mechanic. He got it. He understood the value of sitting in the pews next to people you don't agree with. Isn't there such a value in that? You know, like, I vote for X and you vote for Y, but you know what? You love your family, you love your church, you're trying your best, and you just vote for someone I don't agree with. Are you a bad person?
No.
No, because you're a human being born in the image and likeness of God.
But we don't value that.
But we don't do that in church anymore. Churches should be diverse places in every possible way, economically, socially, educationally, racially, politically. They should be, and they're not, and it's killing us. Anyway, sorry, went off on a tangent there. You're welcome. Or I'm sorry. Here's something I tell young people all the time. College students who are involved in college ministry is like magic. Like, if I could say, like, what is the one thing you would want your young people to do? Go and be part of a church. So be part of a regular congregation you go to on a Sunday, but also be part of a campus ministry on a regular basis too. If you do those two things, you are much less likely to de-church as an adult. That's the magic. The boat is leaky in college, guys, because you're exploring things, you're sowing your wild oats, maybe trying a few different things. You got to tell them this has to stay constant in your life. This thing will be the thing. And by the way, nothing's better than when a good old church lady's like, guys, you want to come to my house for home-cooked dinner on Sunday night?
You better believe it.
I got so sick of that dorm food, boy. I wanted some good home-cooking food. And I had wonderful church ladies who brought me in. Once a month, all it takes, you know, to feel like you're part, you know what I mean? Like, you know what the worst feeling was? When I got sick in college. Because who's going to take care of you? You know, my parents were a long way away. They couldn't come get me, you know, take care of me. And the church was like, you want me to go to CVS and get you some? Yes, thank you. They want to help. They want to make your life easy. I say, I don't need AAA. I got ABC USA. That's my denomination. If my car breaks down, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get in my, not the phone books, I don't have one. I'm going to get on my phone and find the nearest ABC church and call them up, and they're going to have seven guys there within 20 minutes to fix my car, feed me a meal, give me a place to stay, or whatever I need. Because church people help church people. We cannot forget the value of that, right? It's community. And you know what we're dying for right now?
Community.
We're dying for it. We're dying for it. And church provides, and I think a lot of people would come back if they heard that, as opposed to the other stuff. Not that that's not important. Don't mishear what I'm saying right now, okay? Don't mishear it. But people are not being convinced by the theological arguments anymore. They're understanding their lives are lonely, depressed, addicted, left out. And guess what church does? Helps you with all those things. Doesn't fix everything, but it makes life a little bit better, right? That's the way I describe church. What does religion do in American society? Make the world a little less awful. That's it. That's our job, is to make the world a little less awful for those around us. And then, when do people leave? 13 to 30. Most people, this is the leaky boat period, guys. This is when things fall apart. This is when my kid, my oldest, will turn 13 in 6 weeks. I want him to be part of a faith community. I did not want him to be a pastor's kid, by the way. That's my biggest fear. You know, with all the stigma and all the things that, I don't expect anything from him except for him to be, my wife's Roman Catholic. They've been baptized in the Catholic Church. I go to the Methodist Church now often. They went to the Methodist youth group, and they also went to the Baptist Church with me. They go, Dad, which one? I go, just find one that makes sense to you and go. Become part of something bigger than yourself. You know, be part of a faith community. Hopefully one I like, so I can go with you.
Right.
But I need you to understand the value of this and what it's done for my life. You know, I grew up, my parents, I don't come from much. I'm a first-generation college student. And my dad got laid off when I was about 12 years old. And the one thing that kept me in church was there was a basket of food on our step every week from the church.
Amen.
Little stuff like, you know what I mean? Little stuff like that, man. Small things done with great love is all that it takes. And I think to myself, if we didn't have the church, what would we have had? I would probably would have gone hungry. Or my parents would have gone hungry because they would have fed me and not them.
That's right.
That's the church. It's really hard to get mad at that, by the way. You can argue about LGBTQ and abortion and everything else in the world, but you know what you can't argue with? Feeding hungry people, clothing the naked, visiting the prisoner. It's really hard to get mad about that stuff. Maybe we should be more of that, right? Maybe we should be defined by what we're doing and how we're serving. So, how much time do I got? I got time? I got a little bit of time. We're good. These are the books I've written. Here's a little sneak peek, guys. The Great Dechurching sold so well that Zondervan just signed me and Michael Graham to a 2-book deal to do follow-ups to this study. So we're going to write a book on people who have never been part of religion. So the Never Church is what that one's going to be called. So people who never were part of church. And then we're going to write a book called The Great Rechurching, which are trying to find the reasons why people used to be never goers and now are going at least once a month. What are the commonalities that we can find in those groups? Hopefully one will depress you a lot and then one will make you feel a whole lot better. What we found is there's a need for this data out there. People want to understand religion and how it's changing and how it's moving. So I also write a newsletter on Mondays and Thursdays. If you scan the QR code, you can get 20% off a subscription of that. Most of it's free. A little bit of it's paid, like 2 posts a month. So if you scan that, you get 20% off. I also tweet. I also work for an organization called Faith Facts. I'm their research director, and all my job there, it's the greatest job in the world. I get to tell people the good stuff about religion. Like, it does all kinds of cool things, guys. For instance, I'll give you a 30-second anecdote. They went to, in Morocco, they went to the bazaars where they're selling stuff, and they went to the shopkeepers and said, here's 10, not dollars, but their local currency. You've got 3 options. You can keep all of it, you can keep some of it, or you can give all of it away. You know, either give half of it away, keep all of it, or give all of it away. You know what they found out? During the average time, about 70% of people gave all of it away, but when they gave them this experiment during the call to prayer, 100% of people gave all the money away. It's almost like when we're reminded of who we are and what we are, we become more generous. Isn't that amazing? That's what religion does. It makes us, opens us up and become more social, more giving, more generous, more kind. All those things. There's such a value to religion from just a purely empirical social science standpoint. We don't talk about it enough. And part of my job there is to say, hey, religion can be good. It's not always good. It can actually be really caustic, but man, it can do some really great things in America and the world. So, questions? Yes.
Real quickly, you did a little bit in your main presentation this morning, talking about two great awakenings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like historically we're in a similar category in the sense of the statistics. We have this nuns, you say cresting, but
yep.
Doubled. And the amount of people that come, actually there could be hope in the midst of this if the church is willing to stop, look at this, and be open to changing, and not changing theology, but maybe methodology and learning to reconnect with people.
Mm-hmm.
There might be actually hope again like there was years ago.
So,
and that revival that took place in 1870.
Is there hope? That's like the question, right? Is there hope? Can I give you some hope? Here's some hope. So this is the share of people who identify with no religion, and I'm showing you this by generation here, okay? So this is silent generation. These are people who are actuarially not long for this world, just to be frank about it. Boomers, there's a lot more boomers. Actually, did you know in the average church, the generation that still fills most of the pews are boomers?
Yes.
That's bad, by the way, because they're dying. Like, older boomers are in their 60s, you know, like late 70s now, and they're not going to be around in the future. But anyway, oh, where'd it go? No. Oh, go, come back, please. I know why, it's because I'm not doing a presentation. So, look here. Boomers are continuing to leave religion. Right? See that right there? This is Gen X. Notice Gen X. Okay, it goes up 25% in 2008, and it goes to 33% by 2016. But look here. 34% in 2020. 35% in 2022, and 34% in 2023. Notice that? That's a crest, right? Look at millennials. 33, 37, 38, 43, 44, 42. Maybe even going down a little bit, right? And look here at Generation Z. 39, 45, 48, and the most recent data says 42. So there's your hope. So what I was telling you about how we went through this period of rapid growth in the nuns, and now it's slowed down dramatically, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Amongst the younger generation, we've hit a ceiling. Now, I would not bet the farm on this 42% number amongst Gen Z. I think there's some things going on there. I don't think it's going to go above 50, though. And that's if you think about it, that's a big deal. Also, the religiosity of millennials and Gen Z is almost exactly the same, which means we're not seeing this generational drop-off every generation, which means we've hit a wall. We've hit a ceiling, right, where we're not going. It's high. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'll not make this a good thing, but it's not continuing to rise, which is a good thing. Yeah. So, interestingly enough, there's actually more evangelicals living in suburban areas than in rural areas. There's a fascinating fact for you. I can't give you urban, suburban, but can I give you racial data? Maybe that might help. The share of white people who are nuns is now 36%. The share of Hispanic people who are nuns is 36%. The share of black people who are nuns is 36%.
Huh.
Yeah, it's the same.
I said it's over
100. Well, no, 36%, yeah. 36% of black people are nuns, 36% of white people are nuns, 36% of Hispanic people are nuns. But I'll give you an interesting fact about that. If you look at the composition of those non-religious people, for white people, it's 20% atheist, 20% agnostic, 60% nothing in particular. You know what it is for black people? 4% atheist, 4% agnostic, and 88% nothing in particular. So they're not, when black people leave religion, they don't go to the other side, all the way to the atheist side. They sort of live in that middle, that mushy, like, meh, category about religion, which is a big deal. It means they're more reachable than the white atheists. Yeah, back, yeah. 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 So, I've written about this. I get this question a lot. If we allowed more immigrants into America, would America be more religious, right? That people who come to America tend to be more religious. So here's your money graph on this. So the blue line is the entire sample, and the red line is if I took out everyone who was either immigrant themselves or first generation. So just people who have been here for a long time, and guess what the share of the nuns looks like?
Same.
It's exactly the same. Immigration is not a way to de-secularize America, because you know what happens when people come to America?
They get secularized.
They secularize because we're secular. They start looking more and more like us because the kids are looking around going, none of these kids go to church. You know what I mean? We're the weird Hispanic Catholic family that goes to church mass 3 times a week, and they don't go to church at all. I want to be like them, not like you, and so they leave. So that's the problem, is assimilation, right? Which is, you assimilate in every possible way, not just one or two. So the reality is that it's not going to fix our problem, and immigrants look like America after they've been here for a while.
You have the next generations
mm-hmm.
tend to become the same as everything.
Exactly.
In America.
Go ahead.
How does church, school,
Ooh, good. So I actually got this really cool data set of people who went to college, and they were, okay, let me describe this to you. They were given a religious knowledge battery, and not just Christian religions, like other religions too, like Hindu, Buddhist, and everything else. Here's a fascinating fact. The kids who answered more questions right were more likely to retain the faith of their childhood than kids who did not learn about other religions. Guys, we can't wall people off from other faith groups. Actually, learning about other faith groups strengthens your own personal faith. It's called the inoculation effect. It's like why you get a vaccine, right? It's like a weakened version of the attacker. Learning about other faiths doesn't make people leave faith. It actually makes them stronger in their faith. So I'm a big advocate of my kids learning about Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and atheists and everyone else, and then coming back to me and say, Dad, how are we different than them? You know, how do we answer these questions about the world that are different than them? Because I'm not shielding them from that. I'm actually showing them the world and saying, but here's how we go about things. And I think that is a much more effective way than all of a sudden they get to be 25 and go, I've never met a Jew before.
So you're saying if they go from, you know, elementary academy to middle school academy to high school academy,
yep.
And then on from college, you're saying that's saying that's not healthy. Is that hearing you correctly?
I think the most effective thing for them to do is expose. You know, they can go to the academy if they want, but I think the Christian academy should also teach world religions too. Like, I think that's a very good thing. Like, I think when it's only, like, we're only going to teach Christian theology, and especially, like, only evangelical Christian theology. Talk about Catholic theology. Talk about, you know, liberal mainline Protestant theology. Like, there's different ways to understand faith, but then come back to what we believe and why we believe it. Is because what's going to happen is they're going to go 25, they're going to be 25 and go, Dad, why didn't you tell me about Dorothy Day? You know, like, why didn't you teach me about the great other religious traditions of the world? Well, I didn't want you to leave your faith. Hey, can I just say something? Trust God works in the lives of your children. You know what I mean? Like, I know it sounds so simple, but it's so hard to do sometimes. Trust God is working, okay? And be an example of what you want them to be. If you want them to be a Christian, be a good Christian. Treat them like a good, you know, be a good father or a good mother, and they're going to see. I don't need to tell my kids what I believe, because hopefully I show them what I believe by how I treat them, how I treat their mother, and how I treat people I just come in contact with. And they're going to see that and go, I want to do that. I want to have that life of integrity. Not that I'm perfect, because Lord knows I'm not. But I'm also willing to admit to my children when I make mistakes.
Right.
And when I do things wrong, and when I fall far from the path.
Right.
You know, I've sinned against you in thought, word, and deed by what I've done and by what I've undone. I've not loved you with my whole heart. I've not loved my neighbor as myself. I'm truly sorry, and I humbly repent. Like, we've got to be more honest with our kids about our failings too, because if they hold us up as these perfect Christians, they're going to quickly realize that we're not, and that shouldn't push them away from Jesus. It should push them closer to the church. Right?
Again, that's back to real and community.
I don't want them to see me as perfect. I want to see me as good. You know? There's a huge difference between being perfect and good. I'd rather be good. Enough. How much time do I got left? 0 minutes? No! Guys, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah.